From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The president tweeted again about immigration this morning, one day after U.S. border agents closed the port of entry outside of San Diego and fired tear gas into a crowd of migrants. The president claimed, without evidence, that many of the migrants who were running toward a U.S. border crossing were stone-cold criminals. He demanded Mexico deport them back to their home countries and threatened to close the U.S. border permanently. Democrats are railing against the administration's actions. And joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jeremy.
First of all, could the president really carry through on that promise and shut down the border?
In theory, he could. And in fact, the administration did close the San Ysidro port of entry in San Diego for a number of hours yesterday. Ultimately, there'd be an awful lot of pressure to reopen it. You know, that San Ysidro port alone, there's something like 38,000 cars cross every day. I used to live in San Diego. I spent a lot of time sitting in that borderline. It must have been an awful lot of people who were very inconvenienced by this move. And then at the nearby cargo port, there's something like $42 billion in commerce that flows across that border. So, yes, the president could close that off if he wanted to, but there'd be a pretty stiff price to pay for it.
And Democrats are saying that what happened yesterday is a new low to use tear gas on migrants. What's the reaction today in Washington?
You know, the criticism is not only coming from Democrats. There have been some critics on the right who are calling this a manufactured crisis by the administration. It's certainly true that the administration has tried to funnel all of the asylum seekers from Central America, and there's been a growing number of them, into the legitimate ports of entry. And at the same time, it has sort of close down those valves so that only a relative handful of asylum seekers are allowed to cross the port of entry on any given day. And what that's resulted in is this critical mass of would-be asylum seekers who've now assembled in Tijuana, and their numbers are growing. They're looking at weeks, if not months, before they'll be able to make their asylum claim. And all of that has created a pretty combustible situation.
Now, back in Washington, the president has called on Congress again today to fund a border wall. Lawmakers are back in session this week for the last time before the Democrats take control of the House. Is there any chance that in this lame duck Congress that Trump's going to get his wall?
There's certainly a chance, but I think it's not a real big one. The Congress does still need to fund the Department of Homeland Security and some other branches of the government. Most of the government's already funded well into the new year, but the DHS is still needs to have its funding extended. And so that is a sort of a hook, some must-pass legislation, and that's where the president wants them to add some money for his border wall. The House has included a fraction of the billions of dollars that the president's been asking for. The Senate, where the Democrats have more sway since it'll need 60 votes, I don't think there's much appetite there for funding the border wall. So it all depends on, you know, how hard the president wants to press, how willing he is to go to the mat.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, Scott, I believe he did say that Mexico was going to pay for the wall. So
said it
here we
times.
Are, but he's asking Congress to do it instead. Is there a possibility that there'll be a government shutdown over this?
It's possible. Again, there's certainly not much appetite for a shutdown on the part of congressional leadership. There may be some immigration hardliners who would be willing to go that far. And we should say this would not be a total government shutdown, even if it were to happen. It would be only those parts of the government that haven't already had their funding extended.
What about the climate report? The administration released it last week when everyone was busy with the Thanksgiving holiday, maybe to bury it amid all the
news. Not everyone, Jeremy. A lot of our colleagues were right here hard at work, reporting on that climate
report. So, okay. But is there any chance that that report is going to have any impact on what will happen at the federal level on climate change? This came from the White House.
Yes. I mean, as much as the administration tried to bury it, I think it is going to have some impact. Just this week, you're going to see a small number of lawmakers, bipartisan group, who's going to be introducing carbon tax legislation. That's not likely to go anywhere. But this report can certainly be some ammunition for those who are challenging the administration's efforts to roll back climate regulations in court. The court battle will be over the justification for rolling back those regulations, and the critics will now be able to say, look, your own administration has issued this report saying climate change is real, it's happening, it's costly. And that'll be a tough question, I think, for the administration's lawyers to try to answer.
One more thing, Scott, the president is going to be in Mississippi for two rallies today ahead of the runoff Senate election tomorrow between Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith and Democrat Mike Espy. We've talked a lot about the gaffes that Hyde-Smith has made, saying that she wanted to be on the front row for a public hanging in a state with a history of lynchings. What are you watching for in this election? How close is it, do you think?
The fact that it's even remotely close and the fact that the president is holding a couple of campaign rallies tonight in Biloxi and Tupelo is a surprise and shows a certain sort of weakness. But it's still a very red state. And Mike Espy, the Democrat who's challenging Senator Hyde-Smith, has an uphill battle ahead of him.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's turn now to escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine. This latest flare-up started yesterday when the two neighbors accused each other of provoking an incident in the Kerch Strait, a strategic body of water off the coast of Crimea. Ukraine says Russian vessels opened fire and seized three Ukrainian ships. They called it an act of aggression. Moscow says the Ukrainian ships entered Russian waters illegally and also ignored earlier warnings from the Russians that they'd close the strait temporarily. Now, feelings were already hard. As you'll remember, Russia annexed Crimea away from Ukraine in 2014. Ukrainian forces are still fighting a war against Russian-backed separatists in the eastern part of the country along the border with Russia. Will Pomerantz is deputy director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Will, what is your read on what's happened here?
Well, both sides are seeing are using this incident to heighten their propaganda and to heighten their arguments as to why the other is in the wrong. And it is a dangerous game of bluff, and we'll just have to wait and see how it proceeds.
Well, you say dangerous game of bluff. Some are saying it has the makings of a geopolitical emergency. The strait that this happened in connects the Sea of Azov to the Black Sea. This is the disputed territory of Crimea that sits right between the two. An area that's rich with coal, mineral resources. So start with the Russian side. Why would Russia, if it did instigate this, why would it?
Well, Russia had several reasons to do this. One, to show that it is, in fact, in charge of the Kerch Straits. It has built a bridge, and it is able to control shipping that goes in and out of the Azov Sea. So it reinforced its control and its ability to blockade parts of Ukraine and their ability to get their grain and other goods out of the country.
Yeah.
It also Putin can also use this incident to show or argue that this is a provocation of the West and the United States, which has already occurred. So in theory, it could at least boost his popularity, which has sagged a little bit.
Well, and if Ukrainian ships were being sent there to provoke, if they knew that the strait had been closed and they weren't allowed to go through and they tried to go through, why would they do that?
Well, Ukraine has a strong argument as well. It doesn't recognize Russia's claim of territorial waters. It doesn't recognize the annexation of Crimea. And so Ukraine needs to have access to the straits. It wanted to show that it could still send ships through the straits. And therefore, there was a strong argument that Ukraine is actually in the right, that Ukraine is simply exercising its right under an agreement between Russia and Ukraine to gain access to the sea and to allow it free access of its ships to protect its territory.
Well,
so Ukraine has a point, a strong point, that it is within the rules of international law in its actions over the past few days.
Which is why some people are concerned that President Trump has been silent on this issue. This fact, as you say, that Ukraine, that many people believe Ukraine is within its rights. The president is expected to have a one-on-one with the Russian President Vladimir Putin later this week at the G20 meeting in Argentina. You know, there is concern that he's not saying anything about Ukraine because of that upcoming meeting. Your sense of whether or not the U.S. is giving Russia a pass in this moment?
Well, the U.S. has been very strong in the U.N. this morning in condemning the actions. But I think you're right to question to what extent President Trump will challenge President Putin on this turn of events. Clearly, he did not challenge President Putin in Helsinki a few months ago when they met, and it's unclear as to what President Trump's strategy would be. So it's unclear how that meeting will evolve, and it's still unknown to what extent President Trump will try to hold Putin and Russia accountable for the events that occurred in the last 24 hours.
Well, and the president tweeted yesterday, Europe has to pay their fair share for military protection. The European Union for many years has taken advantage of us on trade, and they don't live up to their military commitment through NATO. Things must change fast. Just in the minute we have, is that maybe a part of this equation that the president doesn't want to say anything that would indicate that it's the U.S.'s job to protect Ukraine?
Yes, and I think Trump would want to try to put the more of a demand on the EU to become more engaged. The question is, what can the EU do other than introduce new sanctions? It's unlikely that the NATO allies are going to actively engage in the Kerch Straits to change the reality on the ground. They're not going to, I think, directly challenge Russia or challenge its ability to control shipping in and out of the Azov Sea. So if we're unwilling to do that, the only alternative is sanctions. And I think there is a very low appetite in the EU to increase sanctions. I think there's a different equation in the United States, especially in Congress. And I think it'll be very interesting to see whether Congress demands that new sanctions be introduced. The risk is that the U.S. would get ahead of the EU, and that would cause problems within the alliance.
Will Pomerantz of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. We will watch. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Our next guest needs very little introduction. Senator Bernie Sanders ran for president in 2016 and lost the Democratic nomination to Hillary Clinton. He was just elected to his third term as senator from Vermont, and he's written a new book out tomorrow called Where We Go From Here, 2 Years in the Resistance. Senator Sanders joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm going to start with a question just to get it out of the way. You've been doing some interviews about this book. You've said you will run for president again if you conclude that you are the strongest candidate who can defeat Donald Trump. When do you think you will make that decision?
Well, I think given the fact we have just come off of a brutal midterm election, I think the American people have a little bit tired of campaigns, and I think we got to give them a break. But what we are doing is now talking to people all over this country to see if our message of taking on the billionaire class, health care for all through a Medicare for all single-payer system, raising the minimum wage to a living wage, $15 an hour, demanding that the wealthy and the powerful start paying their fair share of taxes, dealing with climate change, et cetera, if that message is going to resonate throughout the country. And that's what we're ascertaining right now.
How would you describe the results of the midterm elections? Do you think that it was a big victory for Democrats or not as good as you would have liked?
Well, I would have liked, obviously, bigger. As a member of the United States Senate, I would very much have liked the Democrats to gain control over the Senate. But given the terrain that they had to cover and the seats they had to defend, they did fairly well. On the other hand, Democrats won almost 40 seats for the U.S. House, 7 governor seats, and hundreds of legislative seats in state capitals all over America. So I think it was a strong victory for Democrats. I think it tells me that in many parts of this country, people are not only angry with Trump's tax breaks for billionaires, his attempt to throw 32 million people off of health insurance, his ignoring the painful reality of climate change, but they are also, even more so, sick and tired of his divisiveness, his hateful rhetoric, his attempting to divide us up by the color of our skin or our sexual orientation or the country we come from or our religion. And I think people are saying we don't want more of that. We have serious problems in this country. Let us come together to address them.
What do you think happened in Florida and in Georgia with the losses for Andrew Gillum and Stacey Abrams, both of whom ran as full-on progressives and couldn't make it over the top?
Well, if you look historically at Florida and Georgia, I think you will conclude Gillum got over 49% of the vote, which is a very, very strong showing. Stacey Abrams, who ran a brilliant campaign, got over 48% of the vote in Georgia. This is an African-American woman running on a progressive agenda in Georgia. That's pretty good. And I think when you look at long-term and when you look at Florida, which, by the way, during that election passed a ballot item which will give the vote to people who have been convicted of felonies and who served their time, I think what Andrew did and what Stacey did is kind of transform politics in Florida and in Georgia and I think in the South. So obviously, you know, somebody who had campaigned for both of them I wish they had won, but I think no one should minimize the impressiveness of their campaigns.
You write in your book that the leadership of the Democratic National Committee tilted the playing field during the primary in 2016 in favor of Hillary Clinton's campaign. Do you think that the DNC's problems have been fixed going forward?
We have worked really hard. I mean, if you read the book, it talks about a number of things. It talks about the need for us to develop a progressive agenda that speaks to the needs of working families. It speaks to the need to revitalize American democracy and increase the voter turnout. And I'm very delighted by the kind of turnout we had in the midterm election, and especially the fact that so many more young people appear to be getting involved in the political process. The other thing that I do talk about is the Democratic Party has got to come back to its roots. In my view, it has got to be the party of working families. It has got to take on the big money interests, Wall Street, the drug companies, the insurance companies, and stand for the needs of working families in urban America, in rural America, and all across this country. And what I did, and in fact we reached an agreement with Hillary Clinton after the ending of the primary, to work together to bring about long-needed reforms within the Democratic Party. And one of those reforms was ending the absurdity where in 2016, before the first primary vote was cast in Iowa, Hillary Clinton had already secured 500 superdelegate ballots. And that has ended. We work with the DNC, and I think members of the DNC recognize that that process was not democratic. And as a result of the reforms, superdelegates will not be voting on the first ballot at the Democratic National Convention.
So do you think it'll be a fair process in 2020?
I do. I mean, okay. I think clearly it's a – you know, what should happen is if there is a state where one candidate gets 75% of the vote, that candidate should have 75% of the ballots coming from that state. What happened in 2016, there were states that I won by a pretty large majority where actually I didn't even have a majority of the delegates.
What would your reaction be if a billionaire like Michael Bloomberg or Tom Steyer ends up running for president as a Democrat or even getting the nomination of the Democratic Party?
Well, I know Tom Steyer and I know he's a very decent guy. I don't know Mayor Bloomberg. He did a good job as mayor of New York City. But the issue here that concerns me, and it's not just those guys, it is what's happening politically in this country today, and that is as a result of this disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, we have a very corrupt, and let me underline that word, corrupt campaign finance system where billionaires, Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson are attempting to buy elections and sometimes with great success. To my mind, American democracy is not about billionaires buying elections or running for office, buying the seats for themselves. It's about one person, one vote. It requires us to end voter suppression, which we're seeing all over this country. It requires us to end the extreme gerrymandering we're seeing all over this country. So when I talk about revitalizing American democracy, it is restoring power to ordinary people and not just wealthy and powerful individuals.
What do you think the tax rate should be on the wealthiest people in this country?
Well, I can't give you a rate right now, but this is what I do believe. I believe that the Democrats should rescind the $1 trillion in tax breaks that they gave to the top 1% as a result of Trump's tax bill. We have today a massive level of income and wealth inequality. Three of the wealthiest people today own more wealth than the bottom half of the American people. Well over 40% of all new income goes to the top 1%. So what we need when we talk about making public colleges and universities tuition-free, when we talk about a Medicare-for-all single-payer system and guaranteeing health care to all people, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, that is going to require money. And I think it is absolutely fair that in a moment in history where we have so much income and wealth inequality, that the wealthy and private, large, profitable corporations start paying their fair share of taxes.
Bernie Sanders, you talk a lot about economic issues, but you also in this book talk about foreign policy a bit. And I want to ask you, you say that the wars in the Middle East that we've been fighting ever since 9/11 have not been very successful. How would you change the fight against ISIS and terrorism around the world?
Obviously, this is not, you know, no one has a simple solution. But what this is what I fear very much. What I fear is that the United States could well get sucked in to a never-ending conflict in the Middle East, where you have Saudi Arabia and Israel on one side, you have Iran and their allies on the other side, and we cannot allow that to happen. Essentially, what I think is that in terms of the Middle East, the United States has got to play in an even-handed way, do our best to bring people together. And I'll tell you, when we talk about foreign policy, let me just mention one issue which is very much on my mind, and that is right now we have an unspeakable humanitarian disaster in Yemen. I hope that this very week, Senator Mike Lee of Utah and I will be able to bring a privileged resolution to the floor of the Senate calling for the end of U.S. involvement in Yemen. And I think clearly, given the involvement of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia in the murder of the dissident Saudi journalist, Khashoggi, that we need to rethink our relationship with that country.
Do you think that the Trump administration should insist that the Crown Prince be removed from power?
Well, it's not our job to insist anything, but I think we should very much make it clear that the relationship between the United States of America and a government which was clearly complicit in the cold-blooded murder of a dissident, a government which does not tolerate dissent, a government in Saudi Arabia which treats women as third-class citizens, a government which has a very provocative and dangerous foreign policy, which got them into Yemen. Yeah, I think we have to fundamentally rethink our relationship with the Crown Prince and that government.
Finally, I just want to ask you, after the long battle between you and Hillary Clinton in the last election, how often do you talk to her now? Do you have a relationship with her?
I don't talk to her very often, you know, but I think I worked as hard as I could after I lost the primaries. I was in dozens of states all over this country campaigning, doing everything I could to see that Donald Trump was defeated. You know, obviously, Secretary Clinton and I have our differences, but I understood and she understood that we have got to work together not only to defeat Trump,
right,
but also to bring the Democratic Party together around an agenda that speaks for the working people of this country.
That is Bernie Sanders. His new book is called Where We Go From Here, 2 Years in the Resistance. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
General Motors confirmed today that it will halt production at 5 manufacturing plants in North America. Assembly sites in Ohio, Michigan, and Ontario will all see their production stop after December 2019, as well as production at 2 transmission plants in Maryland and Michigan. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So this is a 15% cut in GM's salaried workforce. How many thousands of workers are we talking about here?
So it looks like about 8,100 of what they call salaried or white-collar professionals and another 6,600 from the factories. Mm-hmm. But those factory workers, they may have a chance to transfer to other facilities. So we're not 100% sure on the numbers, but it's a pretty big number considering where we are in terms of auto sales right now, which is a pretty good year.
And GM is saying that these plants that we just mentioned are going to be halting production. They're not using the word closing. Is there a difference or is this just like the beginning of a closing?
I keep reading into this. I talked to an auto analyst who said the assembly plant in Ontario, Canada, the Detroit and the Ohio one are going to likely shutter by the end of next year. These are places that are producing some brands like Chevy Impala, the Chevy Volt, the Buick LaCrosse, the Cadillac CT6 and the Chevy Cruze. These are what they are saying are underperforming vehicles in the whole portfolio of the GM family.
And the Volt is the electric car that they have.
Yeah, and that's the one that's a little bit weird because they are trying to, I guess, redeploy some of this money, right? Because the company says it's going to save about $6 billion by the end of 2019. And what they're hoping to do is, I think, take some of that money and spend a lot of it to really invest in electric. I think what's really going to be tough, though, is that for almost every company, the really hard part of electric is finding a vehicle that is compelling to have U.S. consumers specifically buy them. I mean, think about these huge auto sales numbers of the last 4 years. They are driven, by SUVs, the biggest gas guzzlers out there. So it's not clear that the public wants those electric cars as much as the companies want to get there.
Okay, so back to what you mentioned earlier on, which is that auto sales have been pretty good. What's going on? Why is this happening now? This is going to have a big effect on a lot of these communities in the industrial Midwest.
Yeah, I looked it up. 2015, 16, 17, and 18 are four of the five biggest years for all auto production. I think the problem is that now it looks like it's going to sort of level off and creep a little bit lower. While the company did not say, hey, we are doing this because we think the economy is going to crater next year, there has to be some forethought about the growth level right now, probably likely to slow in 19 and in 20. And as Mary Barra, the CEO, said, she's like, look, I want to do this while we're doing well, not when we have to, when things are going badly.
I have to imagine that for people who are getting laid off from GM, they'll not be happy to see that the stock is up after this news.
Oh, I mean, it's just that's like the cruelest thing. But when a company saves money and has the ability to essentially pay people to get off the payroll who are going to cost them more in the long run, It is good for the stock price. So right at the moment the announcement was made, it was about a 6% pop almost immediately.
Mm-hmm. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Led Zeppelin, hands down one of the iconic bands in rock and roll history. Guitarist Jimmy Page, its undisputed leader. But a man named Peter Grant played a crucial role in the band's legacy. Peter Grant was Led Zeppelin's manager, a larger-than-life character just as legendary as the band he worked for. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock found his story in London.
Led Zeppelin recorded its first album and started playing shows together 50 years ago this fall.
The Marquee Club, which isn't far from where we're sitting now, really. The Marquee was where Zeppelin played one of their very, well, probably their very first London show in autumn 1968. And they went back and played there many, many times again.
Mark Blake has written books about The Who, Pink Floyd, and Queen, among other bands. His latest is about a man who made his name offstage. It's called Bringin' On Home. Peter Grant, Led Zeppelin and Beyond, the story of rock's greatest manager. We met in London's Kensington Gardens.
But in Peter's case, Peter's whole music business career began and was played out where we are now. You know, 5 minutes from where we're sitting was the Cumberland Hotel in Marble Arch, which is where he first witnessed a smashed-up hotel room. That was Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent had a row over a woman, and Gene Vincent tore the door off Eddie Cochran's hotel suite. First time Peter had ever seen anything like that. The manager phoned him, and he was absolutely outraged. He said to them, "We don't do things like that in Britain. You're in the United Kingdom now. We do not do that sort of thing." Fast forward 5 years, and he's got John Bonham smashing up a hotel suite with a billy club in America.
As a young man, Peter Grant worked as a bouncer. He did some acting. You can see him for a few seconds in Stanley Kubrick's 1962 film Lolita. Bearded and burly, he also made a few quid as a professional wrestler. This persona came in handy later when promoters or bootleggers tried to rip off his band. But Mark Blake says working as a theater stagehand is where Grant really learned how a performer hooks an audience.
Yeah, he learned how to do this at the place called the Croydon Empire, which was an old variety of what you call in America like a vaudeville theatre. And that's what he was doing, looking at magicians, showgirls, balancing acts, ventriloquists, all these kinds.
Guys with spinning plates.
Guys with spinning plates, that's right. He later put a plate spinner on the same bill as Led Zeppelin in 1975. And that's where he learned about old school show business. And from there, you know, he started driving acts around, you know, comedians, magicians, the same sort of artists. And then eventually, the visiting American rock and roll groups that came to the UK, Chuck Berry, Gene Vincent, Little Richard, Peter ended up being their driver and road manager.
In 1966, Peter Grant became manager of the Yardbirds. He found a kindred spirit in guitarist Jimmy Page. The Yardbirds fell apart in 1968, but Grant stuck with Page as he put together a new band.
I think what Peter had seen was that the music was going to go somewhere beyond 2.5, 3-minute pop singles. And a lot of what the Yardbirds were doing on stage in 1967, 68 was very, very close to what Led Zeppelin ended up doing. I mean, they were already doing versions of songs like Dazed and Confused.
So long, it's not true. Wanted a woman, never bargained for you. Lots of people talking, few of them know. Soul of a woman was created below. Yeah.
The first two Led Zeppelin records both came out in 1969, while the band was touring constantly.
Yeah, the whole thing with Zeppelin happened very, very quickly, but it happened in America. Peter took them to America very, very early on. They were opening for other groups, Iron Butterfly, Vanilla Fudge, and basically blowing them off stage. It happened remarkably quickly, and they spent most of 1969 touring America. They'd come back for a few weeks and then go back again, playing these kind of opinion-making clubs all across the country. And when the album came out, the first Zeppelin album, it just absolutely blew up for them. So it happened incredibly quickly, but it happened in America first. But that also helped build the mystique. Suddenly they're this British band, this mysterious British band that had gone to America to find their fame and fortune. Also, they didn't release singles and they did not appear on TV. And that was such a revolutionary move at the time. People thought it was career suicide. But this added to the mystique. You wanted to listen to the music, you had to buy a long-playing record. If you wanted to see them, you had to pay and buy a concert ticket. You wouldn't see them on TV. And that was unheard of at the time.
And this was all Peter Grant's idea. He revolutionized, really, what it meant to be the manager of a rock and roll band.
I think this was Peter and Jimmy Page's idea together, but what Peter was fantastic at doing was being the enabler. If Jimmy said he wanted to do something, Peter would do it unquestioningly. And I think Peter understood the power of show business. And I think, again, those strange little lessons that he'd learned watching plate spinners at the Croydon Empire, he brought that into this new medium. He understood show business, and I think that included understanding the mystique of Led Zeppelin, creating an aura around them.
Peter Grant always put the band first. He worked for them, not the other way around. They did the music, he did the aura, and everything else. On the road, drugs were plentiful, hotel rooms were trashed, but Grant was always there to get the boys out of trouble.
When the money really starts to come in, which is around about 72, 73, by which time Led Zeppelin can get 90% of the gate, which was unheard of at any artist. It was normally 60-40 towards the artist. Peter demanded on 90-10, rode out the promoters, and obviously made an enormous amount of money for himself and the band. But with that came problems in his marriage, the excessive touring that was going on, plus cocaine had come into the mix, certainly by the early 70s, and Peter succumbed to that as well. And I think, in a way, the band, or certainly Peter and possibly Jimmy Page, they all got slightly drunk on their own power. And as a result of that, there was a real, tangible air of menace around Led Zeppelin, around Peter. You talk to people that toured with them and knew them at the time, they were terrified of Peter and his entourage. And I think, again, that was something that worked to their advantage. But it brought a dark side, it cast a shadow, I think, over all this success.
Led Zeppelin broke up after drummer John Bonham, a notorious substance abuser, died in 1980. Grant, who always called Bonham his best mate, was devastated.
Measuring the summer's day, I only find it slips away to gray. The hours they bring me pain.
Never really recovered from that. He did dabble in management, but he spent a lot of time in the 1980s. He was with his kids, he was accessible to his children, but he spent a lot of time in the 1980s barricaded away in his moated 15th century mansion in the English countryside, ignoring everybody, ignoring phone calls. He was being looked after by various gophers and minders, some of whom perhaps didn't have his best interests at heart. He still made an enormous amount of money, but he was not really doing very much. And I think there was a tragic side to it. I think what redeems the Peter Grant story is that before he died, some years before he died, he got himself back on track again. And he did that by turning his back completely on the music business and just concentrating on being a family man. Stopped drinking, stopped taking drugs, and lost an enormous amount of weight as well. And that's how he spent the last few years. And I think that that's the redeeming part of the story. But there is a tragedy, definitely.
Peter Grant died in 1995 at the age of 60, the victim of a heart attack. In 2012, the Bristol Institute of Modern Music in the UK launched a scholarship in his name. His daughter Helen told author Mark Blake, "I don't know if you could ever teach what he knew, but the business owes him a lot." For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlaw.
The new book, Bring It On Home, is out tomorrow. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. On Friday, the White House released that devastating fourth National Climate Assessment, and one of its observations, the frequency of cold waves has decreased over the last century. Again, cold snaps are decreasing. But people have long been wrongly implying that any cold snaps contradict the scientific consensus that the Earth is getting too warm. Last week, President Trump noted low temperatures and tweeted, "Whatever happened to global warming?" And here's Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute talking about the report on Meet the Press yesterday.
I'm not a scientist. I look at this as a citizen, and I see it, so I understand it. On the other hand, we need to also recognize that we just had two of the coldest years, the biggest drop in global temperatures that we've had since the 1980s, the biggest in the last 100 years. We don't talk about that because it's not part of the agenda.
But extreme cold is actually also a part of climate change. We need Marshall Shepard, professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Georgia, former president of the American Meteorological Society, and host of the podcast Weather Geeks. Professor, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So on Thanksgiving Day, the day after his first tweet, President Trump doubled down, tweeting out, "This is the coldest weather in the history of the Thanksgiving Day parade and one of the coldest Thanksgivings on record." What's happening here? There are people who could point to cold snaps and say, see, that disproves global warming. What's the disconnect?
Yeah, I mean, I had breakfast this morning, too, and that doesn't mean we alleviated world hunger. And that's what that logic is like. It's just a weather pattern. I often say weather is your mood and climate is your personality. One day's weather, even the week's weather, doesn't say anything about climate, because climate is really the statistical properties of long-term weather. So it's just the flawed logic to identify a cold day or week with disproving climate change.
Well, isn't it also true that the phrase global warming is relatively new, just a few decades old, and scientists at one point decided to move to climate change because a part of the Earth's temperature rising, which it is that there are other things happening, other extremes, and one piece of that might be cold temperatures.
Look, yeah, exactly. When we have the flu, you have a fever. That's one symptom of the flu. There are other symptoms. With climate change, there are other facets of climate change, the frequency, intensity of hurricanes, how often cloudiness occurs where you live, sea level rise. So warming temperatures is just one response of the changing climate system. So it's just a better way of framing it. It wasn't a name change because it stopped warming. It's simply a better representation of what's happening to the climate system.
Well, and talk about climate as opposed to weather. I mean, weather is when it rains one day, and the climate is this overall pattern. And you describe these waves of weather that are climate. Describe what's happening, what you're seeing there.
Well, our weather is actually governed by a series of wave patterns in the jet stream. People are familiar with the high pressure and low pressure. And we actually, this past week into Thanksgiving, we were in one of those troughs of low pressure. And so cold air could ooze down into the mid-Atlantic and Northeast. That's just weather. But climate is the overall statistical long-term averages of those properties and changes. And so to say that because it's cold this week is a refutation of climate change is just flawed. But more importantly, let me add to that. If you look around the globe over the past week, it's still relatively warm. So we have to be careful not to be so U.S.-centric or even Northeast U.S.-centric in describing what's happening globally.
Well, but we talk about there being extremes. You want to point out that there's a far bigger picture, that there's extremes in storms that are expected, extremes in drought. How might an extreme in cold be created by global warming?
Yeah, there's research by colleagues like Jennifer Francis at Rutgers and many others in the peer-reviewed literature that suggests that jet stream patterns are becoming wavier because of changes up in the Arctic in terms of the loss of sea ice and ice cover up there. That affects our jet stream pattern and counterintuitively might lead to more extremes on both sides, whether it be drought and flood or cold and warm, because we get these higher amplitude wave patterns in the jet stream.
Yeah. Look, the report that came out on Friday should be, you know, we've had so many wake-up calls, so many reports coming out, so many calculations as to how much time there is to react to this real problem of temperatures rising and affecting the Earth. Of the many-page report that came on Friday, what hit you?
Well, what hit me about this report is I've often been very critical of what I call report fatigue. We just put out report after report, and it doesn't resonate with the public. But what I found about this fourth national climate assessment that is important is it documented what's happening in the here and now. It focuses on kitchen table issues for the American citizens and the global citizenry at that. Talks about the impacts on economy, health, water resources, things that are happening now. It doesn't put it far off in the distance. It doesn't talk about polar bears. And that's what we need more of with these types of reports, not just all the graphs and jargon.
In fact, it said the hardest hit in the United States will be farmers in the Midwest.
Yeah, farmers in the Midwest, and you know, they grow things that we eat globally. So when we buy popcorn or when we go to buy bread or dairy, those are impacts on our bottom line issues in our own homes. It's not just about polar bears.
Although we care about the polar bears.
Oh, we certainly do.
Marshall Shepard, professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Georgia, former president of the American Meteorological Society. Professor Shepard, thank you.
Thank you.